Welcome, everybody. If anybody's online, welcome to the classes. Let's begin as we normally do. We'll take refuge together, generate the mind of enlightenment, say the introductory prayers, and then begin the class. And as you know, during the class, there's time for questions and also for meditation. The first thing is if you guys be comfortable in the seat. So primarily, ideally, you'd like your spine to be straight, have your shoulders relaxed. Place your hands and feet in any position you like as long as you feel comfortable. Now you can close your eyes completely or leave them partially open. And then just let your body breathe itself. Think that while your body is breathing itself, Shakyamuni Buddha and his entourage appear in the space in front of you. The Buddha is made of golden light, sitting on the throne, and the entourage surrounding them are your own spiritual mentors, teachers of the lineage, other Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, Arahants and protectors. Meanwhile, all sentient beings surround you. And all of us are sitting facing the Buddha and his entourage. So we've come to take refuge in the Buddha and his entourage and his teachings, to put an end to our own suffering and to develop all the good qualities. Why do we want to do this? To help others do the same. We recognize the equality between self and other. We recognize that we are all under the control of karma and affliction. And we understand that this that control can be broken with wisdom. We want to understand that wisdom, develop it, and cultivate it. I think that by going for refuge to the Buddha and the spiritual community, that we will put an end to the causes of suffering. We will develop the true paths and the resultant true cessations. Join me in saying, I go for refuge and by everlasting to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Soul. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. So in response to this wish, this aspiration of ours, lights and nectars stream forth from the heart of each enlightened being above you. These lights and nectars rain down upon ourselves and all the people surrounding us. And the obstacles and hindrances to our spiritual practice are completely removed. The potential we have for methods and wisdom to arise are actualized. And through that process of actualization, we recollect the four immeasurable thoughts of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. We decide to develop these ourselves and then to establish all beings in those states. And then to affirm that, join me in saying, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And again, from the heart of each enlightened being above you, lights and nectar stream forth And they wash over you and over all the people surrounding you. And every obstacle and hindrance developing these four boundless thoughts are completely washed away. And we recollect the field of merit, and with faith in that field, we prepare ourselves now to purify the mind, to accumulate merit, and to increase that merit. And so we say, reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and will. I present clouds with every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions, accumulated sins, during this time, and rejoice in the merit of the holy and ordinary acts. Please remain until the end of cycle, if this is in turn of Dharma from the beings. I dedicate my and others' merits to the great enlightenment. And then to prevent ourselves from clinging to the practices we have done, clinging to them to be inherently existent, we recognize or we recollect emptiness and dependent arising. And we offer the body, speech, mind, and merit, which has been utterly transformed through this wisdom, to now appear as a pure land. So the ordinary way of looking at our skin becomes the surface of the golden ground of this pure land. The stomach becomes Mount Meru. Your arms and legs become the four worlds. And your eyes become the sun and the moon. And offer all of this by saying, this ground, anointed with perfume, stone, and flowers, the dawn of Mount Meru, all continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this and will appear with the heart. May all human beings enjoy this pure land. So the Buddha accepts the offering, he smiles at you, and you look up into the eyes of the Buddha, meeting his gaze. And under the gaze of the Buddha, you feel accepted. You feel at ease. And you feel confident that your practices will bear fruit. And now an emanation of the Buddha leaves his heart and moves through space and comes to the bottom of the crown of your head, now facing in the same direction you are. Now this emanation starts to descend down to the level of your heart, where it begins to expand. And it fills your body and mind with light. It pours out through the pores of your skin, filling the tenderness of the space, and establishing every being within space to now be within the enlightened state. From the vast empty space of the enlightened mind, you hear the resounding notes of the mantra of Shakyamuni Buddha. And you join in saying, Maha Mune Soha. Now, the light begins to withdraw from the 10 directions of space and it re-enters your heart. You feel the seat beneath you, hear the sounds, traffic passing by, and other sounds within the room. So, in other words, you know you're embodied, and you realize that the meditation you've done has been one of imagination. And the process of imagination has imprinted the mind. Ideas providing conditions for your full awakening. So I think that to fully awaken, one of the things you need to do is to find an authentic teacher and to rely upon them. So decide this is what you'll do. You'll do your best to find a teacher, a fully qualified teacher, and you'll do your very best to rely upon them through thoughts and methods and repay their kindness. And now breathing in deeply through your nostrils, exhale through the mouth, with your eyes flutter open, and please move about in the seat, adjust your posture, do whatever it is to use. So I've come to teaching eight in this course on the spiritual teacher. And so this is the last class that we'll actually sort of information in, and next time we meet, we'll do a review of the eight classes. I'll be relying upon these books here, so this really hasn't changed much at all. Primarily, I've relied on the top two books in the core there, Related to Spiritual Teachers and The Heart of the Path. So today we're going to look at three major topics, respecting other lineages and teachers, how to sort of work with any type of crisis you might have in your relationship with the teacher, and what might happen and how you can respond to this happening when the teacher passes away. Okay, so let's look at this first one here, respecting other lineages and teachers. So the key to this is basically to try to keep an open, unbiased mind. And as we've done before, you know, the good student is unprejudiced and open-minded, sort of free from favouring any one tradition. So for us, and of course it's for other people who have religious traditions, you can say, well, this is the religion I follow, but at the same time, be open-minded enough to know not everybody will be doing the same thing. Others will follow other religions, and that's quite fine with us. We understand that everybody is seeking happiness, freedom from suffering. And there are many ways to do that. So we go, okay, wish you well. Of course, you know, when you criticize them, well, I used to like doing it. I used to like arguing with religious people. I had a great time with that when I was a kid. But yeah, when I came to these teachings and recognized that everything actually exists dependently, then I had to be quiet after that. You can't just argue it's one way, it's Buddhism and that's it. That would shut down dependence, wouldn't it? Because, like I said, you meet other people, they might not believe in the Buddha or the Dharma or anything like that. They believe in something else. That's a dependent relationship. And so, because all relationships are dependent, it's like then we're okay. Then when I start talking now to people of different religions, I don't criticize, I listen, I ask questions all about their religion, I don't try to show our differences, all that sort of thing. Because I know they've found a way that suits them. And they often like to share their way, just like I like to share mine, but you know, because you've undertaken this training, you go, you first. And don't fight them, don't put them down. Yep, we're done.
Just, I'm a little bit confused about, so do you mean that it's dependent that the faith that people might have, they have come to that as a dependent
arising.
That arising in itself.
Yep.
So it's dependent on whatever's gone on that they are Christian or
Muslim. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah. Thanks.
Ben?
I was just going to say, if we have the view that our Buddhism is the only way, that implies a certain sense of inherentness about Buddhism.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is goes against the whole
thing. Yeah. So it was quite an interesting experience for me. You know, when you understand that dependent arising, it's like, you know, you sort of think it through and you'll work out what do all people want, what they don't want. You know, you recognize pretty quickly, well, everyone likes being happy. You know, if I sit there and start criticizing your religion and putting you down, just calling you an idiot because you don't know anything, blah, blah, blah. Because I was pretty aggro, you know, and fighting. It doesn't, what's the point? You know, it doesn't send them out of your door happy, does it? And that's what they actually wanted.
I was going to say, but is it okay to pull them up on things like when they go against the very tenets of their religion?
Like, well, if you like, be skillful about it. You know, like, again, I would ask the question: your purpose for doing so.
Right. Yeah.
So, like me, when I was a kid, I just wanted to be right and prove you wrong and say you're an idiot. This is not the thing to do when you're an adult, is it?
Like when you
I just thought it, for me, this is, once you understand, you get some sort of inkling about dependent arising. You know, for me at least, it comes down to the thing that it's kindness. It's the only reasonable response to a world that exists dependently.
Whether that Hindus or...
And it's usually a power thing too.
Yeah.
It's about power rather than
the
core of, you know, rather than making a happier life and being a better person and helping people. It's about power.
For most authentic religions, it's very easy to be open and come.
Yeah, I think this is for most religions, the basis is the same. It's basically kindness, love, or compassion. That's the major thing. The differences become more towards the philosophical ideas. Like,
I'm not even
you have all the arguments you like about that. Which leads me to what I was going to say. It's like, if you can find something that you can agree with, that's what I always look at when I have chats now with religious people, look for where you can meet. Yeah. So there are four, I'll put down a number of different things that you can meet with, but they're different too. But you could, at least I find, you could sort of accept these differences. So here, for the first thing, offered up. So we've got, you know, when you look at religion, there are religions that come out of the sense of a creator. And then there are religions that don't. So we've got creator type religions and religions that don't have this omnipotent creator of the world. And Buddhism is one of the ones that does is the second one. Yet the second choice for the Buddhist is called the Dharmakaya. Now, if you have a good understanding of the Dharmakaya, it's a very, very much like the Christian idea or any idea of a god. So in the Buddhist perspective, from a Buddhist perspective, I could raise this question, okay, so who created the world, right? So many of us say, well, God did, and I have different names for them. You ask a Buddhist who created the world, it's like the mind. And the mind, but from yet the supreme mind is the mind of Dharmakaya, is the Dharmakaya, the mind of a Buddha.
Is that the actual translation of Dharmakaya, the mind of the Buddha?
Yeah, that is what it is.
That is what that is.
Yeah. The Buddha. And it's so Kaya is like a body, and this the Dharma, well, you know, we know what Dharma is, right? The actual Dharma is the true cessation. So it's the mind that's absent, has no impurities upon it. And when you read the stuff about the Dharmakaya, it's like the source of nirvana, of everything good but also it's a source of samsara and nirvana. When you don't recognize the Dharmakaya as samsara, it's like you don't recognize your own deep nature. So you're confused or you struggle, and that's our samsara. But once you get it, this is all the training is about, it's now the Dharmakaya. So once you get it, you're a Buddha. But as we're sentient beings, it's samsara, you become a Buddha, it's the Dharmakaya. Just these two perspectives, you know. So, yeah, like you might argue against this thing about God and blah, 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 but you can always come back in, just relax. And just go, I haven't got something like that with us too. It's called the Dharmakaya. It's not, it doesn't have the characteristics of a
person.
Yeah, a person. I was going to say about this too. If you have arguments with people about like, whether God exists or not, the question is, the Buddhists don't really ask that. They would say, if a creator God did exist, how would they exist? And if they existed as a permanent entity, a single such and such, and this, we can't agree. So there are plenty of gods in Buddhism, but they just don't hold the idea that one of them is the creator of everything.
I kind of like the concept in Islam art to that there are no personification,
right.
No people, because the concept of God is beyond personification,
concepts.
And so they achieve that through geometric design.
Yeah, and leaving a figure out. And this is the same in the Dharma for many, many years until the Greeks came. Right? And then they made up the statues. And so now we had a thing, because before that, you would have just like two footprints with nothing in it in a rock. Like this, like that is gone. He's not there.
Oh.
Then they had the tree, but there's no one there. You're not worshipping the tree because the Buddha has gone. He's gone beyond. So in the early Buddhism, there was an absence of all pictures. There was only later on to this development, but especially within the Mahayana. They brought it in as a skillful means. But before that,
I tried to introduce the notion of dependent arising to a Christian pastor, and that he said God is the absolute, whatever. And I said, does God have is there a creator and a creation? Does he have, like, if it is a creation depends on the creator, and the creator depends on the creation. Tried to introduce that notion to anybody, he didn't grow it.
Now, what like His Holiness often says to the great Christian practitioners, he talks this, is leave emptiness alone. You guys don't do emptiness. So here's one thing where you can meet them and you can relax and go, well, we know about the Dharmakaya. And once you understand Dharmakaya, like you look at it, you go, that's my concept of God. At least it is in my eyes. If I was to talk about God, it'd be like the Dharmakaya. It wouldn't be like the Christian take on it, really practicing practitioners don't have any problems with Buddhists and emptiness. In fact, I've read some wonderful stories about the great Christian practitioners, and they get along really fine with the Buddhists because this idea they understand that you really can't talk about God like emptiness, right? You can talk about it, but it's not it. Not the thing.
Yeah.
It's the same with the idea of a God. In fact, I think when Leonard Cohen does his stuff, the God with the Jewish, right? So it's spelled G, then the missing letter, which is this O, zero, right? Everything then is the D. But you don't put in, you don't signify it with that letter, you put it out. It's like an absence. And again, it's like, wow, again, this is very much like the Buddhists, right? The Buddhists describe it as like an absence, and in the West, God's a positive force. And I said, there's another big difference. But still, you can still see where you can meet, aren't you? At least I can.
I'm reading a book called Awareness, and it's referred to by a New Zealand comedian who's dying of cancer. And this is one of the resources he got into. And It's amazing because it comes from like the 60s and is written by a Jesuit priest.
Yeah.
And it talks about self. And the way he talks about the nature of self is exactly like Buddha's talking.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So these, again, these philosophies and deep thinkers in Christian religion are finding real similarities
to how that's right.
Other religions look at things.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, there's a tremendous Christian practitioner. I just can't get his name, but he looked at God as an absence, but not as a positive thing, which is very that's the Buddhist code. Like, Dharmakaya is an absence of something. It's a mind, but there's also an absence there at the very same time. So yeah, we can meet there and also see difference. Again, you can look at one saviour or many. Both sides favour, you might say God is the one thing, but then you could also say Jesus, you could also say Mary, you could look at the angels. So, they have their big panoply of deities, just like the Buddhists. So we have a Buddha, who are all these bodhisattvas, and on
and on.
Yeah, that's right. So you can sort of just relax and go, you don't need to argue about that. a soul or rebirth. So again, it really comes down to how these phenomena are defined. Because actually, if you really look at the term of clear light mind that goes from one life to another and so forth, you might see some correspondences here with the idea of a soul. So there's many of these, and of course there are philosophers who try to make these things quite easy to get your head around. But often when they do that, you can find ways of arguing against it. Like you've got to say, okay, so a soul, and again you ask, how does it exist? And then I say, well, is it the body of the person? Heck no. Is it the mind of the person? No. Is it the person themselves? No. So it's something other than all these things. And you can say, okay, so is it inside the person or outside the person? What's its relationship to the body and mind? You can ask all these sort of questions, right? And then that's what, of course, most other religions have fallen to heap. You've never thought of those sort of things. But this is something the Buddhists would have thought of, you can apply it to subjects of Buddhism, but you can also apply it to other religions. Again, one life or is it karma and many lives? So the idea, of course, when we, like I said, put these ideas up so that we can just remain sort of open and know that, I know that in religions we have these major differences. It's God or, others, they go chaos. It's some sort of crowd or just a big, And the Buddhists go, cause and effect. It's just like that. Like I said, one saviour or are there many saviours? So all of these, let us try and put up so we don't get sort of hooked up on them and then get carried away like I did when I was a kid. We don't need to.
Is this fundamental differences that we shouldn't get caught up in?
This is why I put them up there, Ben. Because what happens, of course, when you start to, you might start off respecting them. But then when you find the difference in the start chat, you might find very quickly you start to disrespect.
So, for example,
there's
only one Savior, Jesus Christ, just don't argue.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, you don't go, there's like this Buddha and that Buddha, don't do that.
No. There you go. No, it's wonderful. We have a Savior, isn't it?
Okay.
Yeah, like you say, we're fine. We don't need to. People are really certain about things often are. So, what we need to do here, in other words, what we're sort of saying here is like try to keep your mind open. But sort of just, I'll just put these up there. This is a way of keeping the mind open. And it, you know, when you become so sure of ourselves, or the other is very sure of themselves, it's a great way of promoting your own sense of pride and arrogance. It's like, yeah. I have things that are better than you. You are less than me in some way. Right? So we don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the other thing is like, you know, just we can disagree with them, but don't disrespect them when we make our disagreement. So after I got a little whiff of dependent arising, when the Christians used to come and knock on the centre door at Newmarket, now I love coming in. I'll say, come in. And then of course, like, great, now someone to save. I said, sit down, let me get you a cup of tea. And then have a talk. You know, and I'll find all the places that I could agree. I'd even say, yeah, we say that, we say blah, blah, blah. You just go, yeah, it's true. You know, keep going. This last bit, it says, respecting other lineages does not mean blind agreement. So a teacher revered his teacher, Tsulimpa, yet they held a different view on emptiness. So the story is, a teacher was at his monastery in India, and one of the Tara statues sort of spoke to him and suggested, that from this talk, he actually hopped on a ship and sailed off to Indonesia from India. It took about, I think, 13 months. It's been about 13 years there with this teacher called Tsulimpa. Because Tsulimpa was the guy who held the lineages of compassion, and the teacher didn't have them. He was really wise in terms of the emptiness, but he didn't have this compassion. So he went to Indonesia, and first of all, what did he do? He checked out Tsulimpa. He wouldn't go straight to the guy at Chitwe, but then he sent another person, come see what this guy's doing, like checking the lineage, checking his behavior. But it all seemed right, then he went. And then he makes an offering to Tsulimpa. And like I said, Tsulimpa, I think, at the time held a mind-only view or a middle way autonomous view, which is, that's not the final view. And Atisha held the higher view, was wiser, in other words, and had a much more clear insight into emptiness than Tsulimpa. But he never disrespected him because of that. Like, at the same time, he knew Tsulimpa has bodhicitta, and I don't. So, and then very reluctant. So this is the same sort of idea that trying to impart to us, right? That there may be qualities that we have that others don't, but we shouldn't be arrogant about that. Because others also have qualities that we don't. You know? So we should respect the thing here. This is, as a metaphor, think of a river system. Many streams, the Nyingma, the Kagyu, the Sakya, the Gelug, the Theravada, but they all flow to the same ocean. A wise traveler drinks from any clean stream. Only a foolish one would insist that their stream is the only real water. That's it. So this is this idea, right? And so one of the takeaways you can do is that when you meet another person who holds a different view than yours, or is a person of a different religion, just ask yourself, what can I learn here? Because you can learn really interesting things from outside your own way of being, outside your own culture, your own religion. So what can I learn from this person? Now, the next thing I want to talk about is this, a lineage that His Holiness has been quite forceful that we do not follow anymore. And this is the lineage of people who practice what they call Shugden. That is, Rilam's Dorje Shugden or Dolgal. And this practice came about, and the origins were in the 17th century. And at that time, he was this entity was seen as an angry and vengeful spirit. And it was said that the fifth Dalai Lama tried to destroy it through using tantric methods. But he was sort of adopted as a minor Galupa protector. You see, like to protect the Dharma. But then, over time, more and more people practiced it. It wasn't a problem. But when Pabonka Rinpoche came on the scene, so he was this great, great scholar. You've got to see the book Liberation of the Palm of Your Hand. That's all based on his teachings. He had this huge influence on the Galupa tradition, massive. And he took this practice up as a guardian for the Galupas against the other traditions, especially against the Nyingma tradition. Thing is, 30th Dalai Lama practiced, the fifth Dalai Lama was really warning against this practice. And the 13th Dalai Lama also started to warn against the practice. And he asked for Pabonka Rinpoche to stop doing it. So, as you can see, big trouble coming. And Sirius Dalai Lama practiced Nyingma practices, Dzogchen, for instance, high practice. So, Dzogchen's not a group of practice. Then the 14th Dalai Lama also practices Dzogchen, Nyingma. So we've got to stop this practice because it's a practice. What do you call it? Sectarian. But it's like saying the Galupa is the right one and everyone else is out. And actually, we need to do something to stop the others because their practices are wrong. And this deity will practice this deity to accomplish that. So you get initiated as a past, it's a tantric practice. So there's so many people within the group of tradition who are practicing this. Lama Yishu was, Lama Zopa was, as holy as the Dalai Lama was. And then over time, of course, the Dalai Lama was, there's something not right about this. I'm going to check it out. So he checks, goes right back to the fifth Dalai Lama and then decided, we have to stop this practice. This is going to break up. It'll stop religious harmony. And I'm just like, it's like saying, we're right, you're all wrong.
How did that even come about, though? That seems to just go against.
Yeah.
How did that even come to fruition?
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. And like I said, Pabonka Rinpoche was very influential. Yeah, very strong practitioner, terrific teacher, and quite, charismatic.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, if you look back, nearly all the Dalai Lamas, the major group of people, all took teachings from him and took the initiations from him. So, like you can imagine, now it's like you've got a practice and you're saying, well, you have this practice you're doing, it's no good, you have to stop it.
Oh, yeah.
Now, then think about now the relationship between yourself and the person who gave it to you, right? Your guru, and you're seeing them as a Buddha. Now you're in a bit of a problem, isn't it? It's like, oh my gosh, right? So anyway, it erupted here, of course, in these huge demonstrations and things like that. Now, why does the Chinese government got involved? Right? So it was really interesting to see, like, this deity was to, break things apart. And that's exactly what happened. Up to a point, because many of the people, let's say here, 1996, the Dalai Lama asked his students to stop the practice and banned it in the exiled monasteries. Right? The issue becomes public policy, not just personal advice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? So then the Tibetan community splits.
Mm-hmm.
Monasteries voted to ban the practice. But other ones, friendships all broke down, all sorts of things happened. Right? Then, 1997, a triple murder took place. These Shugden people went out and killed You got nervous ones who's up and down themselves. A great teacher, he was murdered, you know, and two other people were too, by Shugden practitioners, helped with the Chinese government. Then Geshe Kelsang Gatso formed a huge organization that they promoted this practice. And so all over the world, demonstrations came up. And what happened is the Shugden practitioners attacked the Dalai Lama and said, "You're a splittist, and you're the one making all these problems." Right? So at that time, like if you're in Australia or New Zealand, all over the world, in fact, a lot of demonstrations outside, which was terrific because it really worked against them. Right? You saw all those people yelling and doing this. It's like, are these people real Buddhists or not? And so in general, the world sort of looked upon the Shugden practices, you know, and said, well, we prefer to listen to His Holiness. He seems more moderate and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so over time, you know, and then His Holiness started giving, we'd go in and he'd say, we'd about to do a tantric initiation. Any follower of a Shugden practice, please leave. Because if you don't, it's going to make it really difficult for you, because I'm against it, and if you've already got the practice, you're all for it. So, you know, just keep on one side. Either give up the practice and take the initiation from me, or keep your practice and don't take this initiation from me. That's how it has to be. And that's sort of how it went.
It's on our code of practice.
Yeah, that's right. This has been going on for 20 odd years now. So from the mid-2000s, these groups were all protesting at the Dalai Lama events, calling them a religious dictator. In 2014, the protests drew worldwide media coverage. But since then, due to the skill of His Holiness and many of his followers, it's all sort of faded away. But there are still many people practicing. So we have this thing here saying, if you're practicing this, either give it up, and you're quite welcome to engage in the practice and so forth. Or you can keep it. And
I think also the new Kadampas was the name of the
Geshe Kelsang Gatso.
I think he's actually publicly said to his people, no, don't do this. I don't agree with you. You shouldn't be protesting. But he doesn't really run that
organization. No, and he's passed away. Passed away.
I think before he went, he said, no, don't do that.
Okay, well, that's a good
one. But he maintained that practicing the was okay?
I guess he never
renounced that.
No.
Can I just double check that? The actual practice, is it one that holds the Gelug lineage above all others and its purpose is to... You know, the downfall of the other lineages, is that the kind of crux of it?
But not, maybe the primary against the Nyingma lineage, but sort of any lineage that wasn't Galupa.
Right. Yeah. So even that, when you say that, that just kind of sounds
weird and wrong.
Wrong anyway, doesn't
it? Yep. The Shugden followers claimed denial of care and schooling in India. But both Amnesty International and the Delhi Supreme Court found no proof of official abuse. And one of the things I've noticed is there are no pictures of the Dalai Lama. And there are no books by any other Dharma teacher. They are all by Geshe Kelsang Gatso. Now, those books are really good.
Yeah.
They really are. And, you know, what's really interesting is like, Kinsa Rinpoche, we grew up with this guy, all of us, and yes, he was really talented, and so some of those books, I find that they've been the best of their type in terms of subject matter, so I had them all, and then this thing came out, so I didn't have to talk to Geshe. And I made sure I went through more often. There's nothing in any of these books about Shogun. And then he put one out and there was. And so that was the only one I didn't buy. I need to know about that. All the rest is just sutra. So the sutra practices, no problem. This is tantra. But of course, you know, like in a way that Tibet's practices, they merge the sutra and tantra. So you might be thinking that you're all doing sutra, next thing in comes. It's like, what? Yeah. Anyway, like I said, we haven't, I think those days have gone over, everyone's out there shaking and yelling and stuff. I also noticed there's quite a difference between the general attire of the monks and nuns of the new Kadampa tradition and the normal Gurupa monks and nuns. Like if you come across them, you see they look quite scrappy, but the way they dress.
Do they still wear robes?
Yep.
Same colours?
Yep. Yeah.
I've noticed that they wear more reddish robes than maroon.
Okay, right. More red, more sort of red than maroon. Yeah, I look at it, why you guys don't seem to have much pride in your dress of being a monastic. But that just probably me. Maybe I just saw, you know, one and it was the off one. Everyone else was really good. Who knows? Yeah. Okay, let's do a meditation. Oh, so Dorje Shuddha is this spirit worship. So arguing against because it's divisive, but you can actually see it has taken place. Right? And this guy's like it's a hostile, protector type thing. Okay, let's do a meditation. Oh, that's interesting. No, we've just done what's interesting. One of the things here is that, yes, we talked before about God or Dharmakaya. Okay. So the guru that we meet in our everyday life, suppose your guru is Kinsa Rinpoche, suppose. So when your relationship to it is now you see the Kinsa Rinpoche is the Dharmakaya appearing in human form. This is the, so if you have a guru and you have that relationship, that's how you see them. This is the mind of the Buddha, the form of the human being. Who is Buddha or what is a Buddha? So now the nose of a Buddha is Buddha. Yeah, so it gets a little thingy, you know? Yeah, we can read about Dharmakaya. It's quite, and if you read about other religions, it's really hard to find the difference there. The way I sort of see it is it's like it's as if it's the, So when you're out and about in the world, right, and there's the light that you see, right? You see everything because of the light, right? So all things are appearing because of the light, right? But you might not see the sun.
Okay.
Right? So all these phenomena are manifestations of...
Oh, okay.
Right? Yeah, only appear to you because there's this light. Right? And then everything appears. No. Like, you know, like we say, like you know, we look up there and go, oh, there's the light. But just like the sunlight, right? You know, it doesn't look like that, does it? It's just everything is open and everything appears.
So then it's the sun and the Dharmakaya in that?
Well, it's the light from the sun.
It is the Dharmakaya.
Yeah, so it's like this is the expression of this other phenomenon called the sun, right? And in that, it shows everything.
Oh,
so the mind of the Buddha holds, the Dharmakaya holds all objects there's no object that mind does not know. Mm-hmm. All objects appear to that mind.
But in that analogy, who or what is the sun?
We don't go there.
Okay.
Expression of truth. But then again, we're trying to single something out, right? We go, oh, there's the one thing that gives all of this.
it's dependent on everything, right?
Yeah, that's right. So don't we go to like, yeah, so it's like here we have light, which is dependent.
Yeah.
If you go to the sun, now what's the dependency?
Well, it's the source
of the
light.
Yeah, but it seems to be separate from it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Independent of it. Right? Like you look at the sun and you look at everything around you, right? Those people are all independent of the sun, aren't they?
Yeah.
So that's the problem of light. Like, again, looking for this. Yeah, the one thing is the Dharmakaya. But if you just look at the sun, what are you going to get? You're going to get just...
go blind.
Yeah, well...
burn your eyeballs off.
Okay. Excellent. So then we talk now about... So this is to do about sort of the behaviours of students and gurus. And talk about sort of unusual behaviour. And what do we do to meet unusual behaviour? So here it says, when there are special gurus and special disciples, like Talopa and Naropa, or Mapa and Milarepa. So the guru here is Talopa and his disciple is Naropa. The guru is Mapa and his disciple is Milarepa. Now, if you've read any of those biographies, these students get one heck of a teaching from the gurus, right?
Hard work.
Very hard work, right? Very, completely different than what you'd normally expect, isn't it?
Right.
But then again, it's like because they're special. So this does not go for people like us. So they go, well, am I special? I don't know.
I'm going to jump off a cliff.
Yeah, these sort of phenomena. Right? And so, in fact, Mapa said to Milarepa that you must not train your disciples as I have trained you. Right? Which is really different, isn't it? Because most teachers train as how they have been taught. But because the training was so harsh to both of these people, he said, don't do this to other people. I can do it to you because I'm special and I know you are and you can take it. But ordinary, this is not the sort of thing you do. Yeah, and, you know, the Buddha says, don't accept everything just because you respect me. Is this question? And so, of course, this is really about these relationships on the tantric, but many of the instructions are from a tantric perspective. This question, if total devotion belongs to the highest tantra bond, what kind of trust is right for a sutra level teacher? We have faith in sutra too.
Yeah. So you have to check all.
Well, so the answer is here, with the sutra teacher, you build your trust up slowly. And of course, you know, it's take your time, blah, blah, blah. And you don't have to project the Buddha-like status onto an unexamined teacher. You know, remember this idea that when we see the teacher as a Buddha, it doesn't require that they are one. But we're doing it from our perspective for just good reason. Now, this next slide I've got Franciscan people, right? So, you know, of course, it used to happen in the past. But the thing is, when a teacher acts in an unusual way, three things matter most of all. First thing is, check your mind. What looks like a fault in the teacher may reflect your own view, not the teacher's true nature. Second, know your own level. On the sutra path, you test the behavior against the Dharma. On the tantra path, a fully qualified master may act strangely for deep reasons that benefit you. Third, guard your response. Don't let confusion turn into criticism, which creates heavy karma and will block the realizations. So in brief, we need to examine our own mind, know what level we're up to, and guard our responses in these unusual behaviors. And as a thought-provoking question, it says, is it ever right to speak up about a teacher's unusual behavior? Or should a student always reframe it as impure perception? Now, people, this is where people get into trouble. And this has happened a lot in the past when some of the lamas have put it on to the students to have sex with them. And they took the students, oh, it's my own impure behavior. Went along with it and trouble eventuated. So the answer is, in fact, is it ever right to speak up about a teacher's unusual behavior? And the answer is yes. Yeah. So I've got a really good book and a really good Dharma student, this guy, Westerner. And he found out that one of his own teachers, one of his own gurus, was doing things that he shouldn't have been doing. It wasn't Dharma behavior, just like what to do. Yeah. So he's the smartest thing possible, I thought. Go and ask the Dalai Lama. So he did, right? And so the Dalai Lama said, oh, yes, we must call him out on it. He says, but not in public. He says, oh, yes, yes. He says, and he says, and I will tweak his nose when I see him next time. I said, right, look out, the Dalai Lama says it to you, criticizes you, better look out. Yeah. Yeah, so this fellow had to speak up. And thank goodness he did. Now, whether the guy's behavior changed or not, I don't know, but there is a way of doing these things. So when you see these, and again, if you read any of the Chogyam Trungpa, or what's it? Chogyam Trungpa. More in the biographical books, there's some amazing tales on that. And like his behaviors, wow. Like he nearly bought the Dharma undone in America. His behavior was so outrageous. And only thing that saved it was the Dalai Lama turning up in America. And you get another look of what a Dharma practitioner looks like, and the government went, okay, we'll back off then. But he was going to be in big trouble. But in fact, one of the stories is very much like this. I read the story where he was carried naked on a big, like a big platter type thing with the students headed up like that. He sat on the back like drunk, right? And it's like, oh. Yeah, that's right. Right. So a lot of people, it's like, yeah, it's all, you know, pure appearance, blah, blah, blah. But who knows? So this is what I do. When people behave badly or something, you can always take something away from it. It's like, I won't do that. Like, if you don't like it, don't do it yourself. If you think it's harmful and hurtful, then, you know, it's not so much to criticize them for it, but decide yourself, I won't do this. What can I learn from this? You might learn what not to do, how not to behave. Which is a good lesson, isn't it? There's been something troubles you about a teacher's behavior, pause, then ask, is this a real Dharma violation or is it my pride, my expectations or mood covering what I see? Says, that one question can protect both the practice and the relationship. In 50 verses of Guru Devotion, it says, explain your position politely without damaging the bond or your integrity. In fact, you know, because this, like I said, Geshe Kelso Gatso was one of the first lamas invited by Lama Zopa and Lama Yeshe in particular, and they ran a huge operation in England, and then had this breakaway where the students and Geshe grabbed the whole building, everything, right, and ran their own thing. I assume, of course, you know, one of our teachers, Venerable Rabina, had a guru-disciple relationship with Geshe Kalsang Gyatso. In fact, many Western Sangha in the early stages of FPMT did. Because he was, like I said, a great teacher, do all stuff, and this all this business about the deity, you know, wasn't there, you know. But it was great talking to her about it, where she says, no, I really appreciate it, really, I sincerely, all these wonderful teachings he gave me. You know, but I don't do that practice, and I can't have anything to, I'm not going to talk badly about it. But yeah, that's what you do. You don't talk badly about them. You just keep your distance. So here's a quote from the great Fifth Dalai Lama. He says, without generating anger or heresy, and thus creating obstacles that destroy your own liberation and enlightenment, and with guru devotion, skillfully try to get permission from the guru not to do the heavy negative actions that you cannot transform into virtue. This advice is like a middle way. Not blind obedience and not disrespect. In other words, if a guru asks you to do something you cannot turn into virtue, in other words, a clear non-dharma act, don't comply. At the same time, don't react with anger or doubt either. So one time, one of the students that comes here and leads classes, I think he might be doing something on Sunday, Corey Jackson. So he's got a really good relationship with Kinsa Rinpoche. But yeah, you know, if you've met Kinsa Rinpoche, he's quite strong. Right? And him and Corey have, like I said, a good relationship. So one day, Corey came up to see him and things like this. And his Corey's like right there. And Kinsa turned around and said to his to the nun that was there, who was this fellow? Right, just like that. And Kari just felt this like self-grasping boom, straight away. Oh. It was like, but it like it puts you right on the spot, doesn't it? Like it really is where you actually are. Then Corey was saying, I kept looking, like, it doesn't even remember, you know, all these things. Is like, no, man, it's the lesson. Which you got, of course, you know, but you still have to go through your own confusion first of all. Right? It's like, what? What?
I've got to say before, till I've been open, all right, there's a special teacher with Arrows of Special Students. Did they know themselves about special students?
No, they didn't know them. No, they know the teacher. They
didn't. The teacher knew that of them.
Yeah.
But they didn't. They weren't.
No, they never thought that. No.
I was just wondering, we have delusions of grandeur. We go, I wonder if I'm a special student. I can take this.
Yeah, well, that's what this was saying. Like, this is like the warning for that. You know, the idea, I think the idea is check to see, are you a special student?
Yeah. How would you know?
Right? Yeah, right. Good question. What makes you so special? So, like, if you look at with Middle Raper's relationship with Marple, he made all these mistakes, right? And Marple was really fierce with him.
Hmm.
Yeah, and in fact, Middle Raper at one stage was about to commit suicide. It was only then when Marple sort of like backed off a little. So he's not a special, you know, he's just like. He must have had something there that Marple saw, but to get at that thing, he had to be really strong enough. Because remember, Middle Raper killed about 20, 30 people.
Mm.
You know, his own relatives. He tried to kill the bad guys, he killed all the good guys, and the bad guys got away. And so you can imagine the guilt. Right? And then he knew, oh my gosh, my destination is hell. What I've done. What can I do?
Purify,
how can he purify all that? Yeah, that thing. And you look at, so what he did first of all, you know, he went for a Dzogchen master, and the master gave him instructions. It was so simple. Oh, I'll do that. And of course, it didn't work. And he came back and said, what happened? You know, he says, you got to go and see Marpa. you know, you try to get away, all sorts of things like this. So from that sense, you know, he's an ordinary sort of person, isn't he? But he became special in that he could take Martha's treatment of him and still hold Martha with devotion.
Maybe at a more human level, at our level, like a Venerable Revere talks about how Lama Geshe, he was always very kind and loving to everyone else, but to her, he ignored her. And he treated her
quite disdainfully, very fiercely.
Yeah, really.
She needed it.
She was a very aggressive person when she was younger.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, she's still, she's not aggressive, but she's fiery.
She says
this herself.
She says, my lesson to help me develop more humility. At first she didn't know why and she'd get upset and everything, but she was a special, like special Ethan. She didn't give up. No. She didn't go, I'm going to throw it all away. And like at our level, something that, you know, I don't want to get bashed. I think it was like that.
I went with my own cancer repertory now, me on mine. I cried that night and so said, I'm never going back to that. But do you reckon, like, he would, I did come back. And would he kind of know that, like that he could push you that far?
I don't know, but I think he cares enough about us to be wrathful to us too.
Right.
You know, so like it's not done at his anger or his disappointment.
But I could have easily said, that's it, I'm never
going to know. I know somebody who did just that.
Right.
And I listened to them, I heard the whole story, I was like, oh, you missed the lesson.
Yeah.
She had been criticized by somebody else, and in response to that criticism, found fault with the other person.
Mm.
Yeah. So he just went, you need to look at your own mind. You know, the faults are in your own mind. And that was it. Really like that. This is what, and that was it. No more going back.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought, yeah, that's true. But like I said, at that stage of her life, she wasn't ready to, she couldn't accept it. You know, so this was, you know, sort of too harsh at the time, for her at least. I guess I never hear come out, this little one I think you've seen here, leading up to this, sex with your mentor.
No.
Say no, that's right.
Say no.
Oh, man, it's funny saying that. I just thought Lou Reed's song, Sex with Your Parents. Anyway, so here's the out for you, right? So this is probably not why do there have been gurus that have been on to the men too? That's for sure. However, so if it happens to either of us, men or women, this is our response, right? I'm so sorry, but my realizations don't equal yours, so I have to decline. Because the only permissible way you could have sex with your teacher in this tradition is you have to have the same realization as them as on a really high level, tantric level. In fact, the example I give you, there was a monk, he was Kalupa, if he was. He's quite, what's the term when people pay you a lot of attention?
Revered?
Yeah, he was revered, but there's also like there's something about him.
Charismatic,
thank you. Right. So he had some sort of charisma. Right?
Mm-hmm.
He was American, he was right into the technology, and he ended up having sex with one of his students. And so he was asked by his teacher to disrobe because you can't do that, right? So he refused.
Michael Roach.
Yeah, Geshe Michael Roach. Right? And, you know, he ended up having this relationship, and then a murder took place up there, a killing took place because this woman left him and took up with another person, right? And, you know, so, you know, look, this is, yeah, we know this, right? And this fellow is in robes, and he knew the Dalai Lama, Dalai Lama, Lama's life of Rinpoche, everyone was saying, look, you just can't do this. Yeah? Please, you have to give back your vows and your robes. It's over for you. He never has, and he's keeping them, right? That's how it is. And he's, many of his students left him, of course, but he still has a number of them. And those who were his students have been quite heavily influenced by him. And so this, was a very, so for him to be able to do that, so Lama Zopa, wrote the big message, the kind of thing, that's right. So Lama Zopa says, if you can say, like, sit here and look at a tree with fruit hanging on it and make one of those fruit fall to the ground and then go back and reattach itself to the branch, then you can have sex with this person. This is the thing. And besides, the sex business is really high Shoda Tantra, and the monk in the Galupa tradition, the monks have to disrobe.
Have monks done that in order to practice?
Because it is the thing is so the sex in tantric sex is very different than normal sex, right? So if the man has an orgasm, the whole practice is shot through. You've failed. So you have to have this ability to be able to control your what they call control your inner winds and fluids, and your what you're trying to do here is create bliss. So the highest bliss of human experience is sexual. So you have to you can't do it like a human, of course, but the idea is you see yourself as a deity. You have to divine pride. You're not a human having sex with another human. You're a deity bringing method and wisdom together. And the woman is the helper of this, is the wisdom aspect of it. So neither of you are to have an orgasm. And so it's in the tantric way, it's the bliss that realizes emptiness. And so you can have renunciation, you can join the bliss and emptiness. Now you can conjoin renunciation and emptiness. You can join bodhicitta and emptiness. There you can join bliss and emptiness, because the tantra path is the path of bliss. It's how to take pleasure into the path. Here's the simple way out. We don't need to get angry or blah blah blah. Yes, I see. Here we go. It says, even if the guru shows the act of sexual misconduct, it signifies the unification of method and wisdom and is done to receive and increase realizations. Now, if you just took that literally, gee, that would really throw you.
Yeah.
So this verse comes from the Kagyu teaching on the pure view. If you're at this level, the pure view is, I am a deity. The pure view, and you are too. And so you have to, seeing every action of a fully realized guru as wisdom, not ordinary behavior. The sexual misconduct here does not mean abuse. It refers to the completion stage tantric practice of Mahamudra, where the union of method and wisdom helps an advanced yogi access the subtlest clear light mind and cut through dualistic thinking. So this is this is what the goal is of a tantric practitioner, is to realize emptiness with that subtlest clear light mind, the mind that you will realize at death time. Because that mind is so much stronger and more powerful than the ordinary conceptual mind, it just lays waste all the delusions. That's what they call the quickest way to become enlightened.
So that's that happens at death as well, but
We're doing it while we're not dead. That's right. And so this is this idea of bringing the winds into the central channel, bringing them up, we experience pleasure, and dropping them down. They bring them back up, they drop them back down. But we're staying on the empty object. Yeah. So this verse trains the disciple's mind. It's not a license for a teacher to exploit students. Another thing, so I really like this movie, Rogues in Red. What have I written here? They will use your naivety to take advantage of you. So an example, right? So Miffy and I are down to see teachings by His Holiness in Sydney. A monk walks up to us and asks us for money. Now, straight away, you go, monks don't do that.
Yeah.
Right? And he wasn't, but he was dressed up as a monk. Oh, and he was going around hitting everybody up out around there. Right? Yeah, somebody's come over since, you know, and gone, oh, Western has given money out. Great. Off he goes down.
Did you see other people give
him
money?
Oh, yeah. They don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I said, well, you can't, the spiritual side giving the money, but we're not going to stop that. Yeah, but from his side, so let's just, we're running short of time. I just want to give you a quick example. There are people who behave rubbishly, and they look good people. Now, if you can't, so suppose you can't resolve your differences or your difficulties. So what to do then? Then keep your distance from the teacher. Avoid being angry towards them. Keep a neutral attitude. And like Rabina did, acknowledge benefit. They may have been, like at least they've taught you how not to behave. And lastly, the thing is like cultivate a new relationship. There's what to avoid. Do not slander or denounce the teacher publicly. Do not copy the misconduct and call it devotion. So this has happened in the past with Chogyam Trungpa students and also with the fellow we were just talking about, Magishu Michael Roach. And do not give up your practice out of bitterness. And that's a simple, easy thing to do. Many of us have a whole lot of unaddressed traumas, aren't they? And then somebody that you hold in high esteem says something harsh to you. So it's really easy just to be so hurt, you don't want to go back. Yeah. Distance yourself quietly, keep your ethics, heal yourself and don't slander. Okay. These two, we're letting go. So we've got our interesting thing about the meditation, I'll let that go. What about when the teachers pass away? When the teacher dies or passes away, so what's the term they use? What's the term they use here?
The aspect of
passing away. Given the aspect of passing away. Yep, that's right. So when that takes place, grief is a natural thing that should take place. But don't let it sort of close yourself to the practice that they left behind with you. In other words, you want to keep your relationship alive in your practice. Another teacher has passed from this life. Try to honor the teacher by living the teachings and stay open to other qualified teachers. So some of you might have heard of the author and nun Pema Chodron, read her books. Yeah. So her root guru was Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. Yeah. And she got on fine with him, well with him, Very good nun, writes well, good books. Then he passes, right? Now what to do? And so quite a few years passed, and she was at some conference, and she came out of her room, and a monk came out of his room, and they looked at each other, and she felt something. Anyway, over time, she ended up talking to him, and they had a chat, and then she decided, yep, this is my new teacher. I can't remember his name, but boy, he's a good-looking fellow, that's for sure. He married an American woman, And she's a terrific practitioner. She is. They've got children.
Did you work with Zigar from Pashay?
Yeah. And his wife, and they've got good meditations if you come across this. They're both in the Kagyu lineage.
Can they marry?
Yeah. Yeah, so he. You could read about this. In fact, the other thing happened too here was a great practitioner living in Melbourne for years, Pranab Rinpoche. So he married an Australian woman. And they've got kids, yeah, and he passed away. So it's really only in the Gurupa tradition that there's this thing of if you're not their monks, you know. Perhaps some of the other, they're just a bit different. Yeah, and like in the Sakya lineage, they have the lineage is passed down to their family members, so they have to have children. Yeah, but like I said, our tradition is no. You want to get married, you want to have fun, take your robes off, go and do it. I think he doesn't think it's fun anymore. Anyway, that's the end of our class, I think. What's it say? That's right. So, if you don't have a physical teacher, your teacher is the teachings themselves. Yeah, so the Buddha himself said that. It might have been Ananda. One of the students asked him, so who's got to be the boss now? And the Buddha said, the teachings. Yeah, but if you look at the actual refuge, isn't it? It's the Dharma. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, of course, it's supposed to be coming from a living being that you're looking at as a Buddha rather than a book. And as they say, nobody's ever got enlightened reading books. So they're helpful, but it's limited. Okay, so what's our takeaway? Respect other lineages. You know that when you have a crisis with devotion, don't be slanderous, don't be angry, just like back away, calm, quiet. And when the teacher passes away, then the teacher is the text. And so next week we'll go through these assessment questions together. Okay, so we spend time here studying, trying to get an understanding of the topic. We want to dedicate this virtue to our full enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. So due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may our quickly attained state of the Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. But supreme dual body teacher, not yet born and rising grow, may that born have no decline but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. The wish granting, wish fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world. To the incomparably kind teeth, that's all I beseech. May all your wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And if a quick filing of Rinpoche's reincarnation. In holding and spreading the Buddha's precious and complete teachings for explanation and practice, you wore the armor of patience that is never discouraged. Incomparable, venerable Guru, to you I make this promise. Okay, that's it for this evening. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.